we are about halfway through a facility plan, and we have in two buildings have support for well over $3 million, and we anticipate probably an equivalent amount in the second half being needed of our facility plan. The choice of whether to have these kind of buildings or not is really for us often one simply of safety. The kind of kids that we are serving on the tax part of the district have the kind of needs that unless we have buildings helping us, someone will be hurt. And so that has been a primary need. But in addition, what we have learned in the first half of our building plan is that this is a far better use of money because we're able to be more efficient in other ways, which I referenced in the video. We can be more efficient with our staffing. We can be more efficient with our transportation, and especially more efficient with the energy that we get from these buildings. So these buildings are expensive. We learned that those buildings are also very expensive. With that, I will pass out a fact sheet that summarizes some of the key points, but I open it up to your questions.
Thank you, Susan. Before we open it up for some questions and dialogue, I would like to mention that Representative Lewis, who represents the state here, is one of the leaders. She has a regular day job, and so was unable to find a way to get the time for her patients. Senator Pam Mason, too. I also want to know whether if there are any of you here who would like to testify who have a time problem sometimes, if you may. So thank you very much for that presentation. Are there representatives here who have questions?
Was that new facility to replace the one? All the things that we got pictures of?
Yes, and in addition, actually, five additional programs. In addition to the one you saw, we're moving into that building, and we are converging a number of smaller sites into a large one. And that actually is a great movement to get by contract on 74, and we believe that we're converging into quite a partnership with the community in that area, Hudson County. And actually that by the very interesting for the partnership as well. One of the things we've come to realize is that oftentimes people say they think outside of the box. But what we've learned is when we build the box, lots of people seem to be able to afford partnerships. So it's been an incredible phenomenon of just the price of those partnerships.
What kinds of relationship do you have with that?
We actually are in exploratory conversations. One of the things ESI is interested in is perhaps a partnership around career technical training for the students, or maybe the area limited students that are in that building, or other area high school kinds of kids, where we may customize the career technical training in partnership and funding with ESI, or six credit basis.
You were discussing funding for the construction of this new facility. Do all the funds come from the state school districts, or is there a component of state funding as well?
Right now, all the money is coming to our member district based on a tuition that we charge, with a brand of that charge being specific to the facility cost. Our member districts then in turn use the current lease levy legislation to pay for that. One of the key things that we are coming to understand is that the current lease levy amount for K-12 districts is about $100 per student. If they are a member of an intermediate, there is an additional $25 that of revenue that they can levy. The amount of $100 for K-12 has really not changed since 1990, is my understanding. And yet, as I have suggested, kind of kid reserve, our person changed since 1990. And so we really feel the legislation that hopefully will be moved forward to increase those amounts will meet the kind of needs that we're seeing coming out of our public school.
In that regard, have there been discussions about is there a specific piece of legislation present that you are aware of?
We are moving forward in conjunction with AMC and NASBO. Increasing in the refunding for K-12 from $100 per student to $175. And additionally, if you're a member of the ministry in intermediate, the increase will be from the current 25 to up to 50. So between the two, those will be the increases that will be thought to be able to get the
that's a lease deal. When you were constructing this new facility, were there any issues as far as state regulations or restrictions that impeded the design and construction of the building? As far as square footage requirements?
My recollection is what we did was purchase an old elementary school, and that much of the footage that you saw in the video was an old Richfield elementary school called Lincoln Hill. And what we've been able to craft via city and state approval process is that we could maintain that facility with students in it while the new building was going up right with the store. And they literally are only a few feet from each other, and that really has been quite an important process for us because we needed to maintain food somewhere while we were building the building over a course of about 2 years. So via the approval process, we were able to get that cleared, and when the new building opens this summer, we will tear down the old building, and that will become part of the building. And we certainly welcome anybody that wants to visit that new building.
Thank you very much. Is Superintendent Matt here? Superintendent Wolcott?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
welcome.
Thank you. I want to tell our story on the referendum on information of voters. I am Carol Rogers. I'm superintendent of our school. We're currently running our second referendum for renovation of three school buildings on our main campus. Referendum is in 2025. We are at this time ultimately have decided that we ultimately face by all the buildings that will ultimately face throughout the state. We have 18 buildings constructed beyond the goal of 50 to 60 that are in a major reinvestment. The goal of the reinvestment is to update the modern campus to provide quality of environment and efficient and reliable operations that yield savings in environmental and energy efficiency. From the time these buildings were originally constructed, the first performance of change in such an area of the quality of the practical environment and the satisfying guarantee. A high-quality classroom environment is created by addressing the problems that we're attempting to address. Temperature control, humidity control, low sound levels, cast appropriate lighting, effective air distribution, ventilation, control contaminants, sound distribution technology, and reliable operations. The proposed upgrades in our buildings will create a high-quality environment utilizing current technologies and energy efficient strategies. The building is in our building,
Why? That's the there in the maintenance to use is a program called Health and Safety Risk Creator. And the idea behind that program is to allow school districts to be able to discuss this and make other fire safety and life safety in their school districts. In 1993, because of some levy caps and other things, the health and safety program wasn't available to all districts in the year. And so the idea was to pull the large school districts out of that category, create a new category for them so that all the smaller districts could have the same access to health and safety level. But at the same time, that large group of districts, on recommendation of the second grant, were given the ability to use the third grant. So essentially what happened was that group, the large group of districts, got the authority to do the business by jumping all the districts. And it was based on, at that point in time, it was just 1 million square footage limit. And 14 districts initially qualified for that limit. And then the smaller 1.5 million square footage limit with the higher building.
And this recommendation to establish this limit for large districts was predicated on concern about too much bonding, or what was the rationale?
Mr. Chair, my take on this, and obviously we hold a different view than I on this, but the concern really that the legislature was facing was the unequal access on the regular health and safety money. And I think there was very little attention given when that law passed to the great maintenance aspects of some of those people that were at the department at the time to speak to their motives, but I think it was a surprise to many at the end of that session when in fact we've got the ability to be personal. And the first couple of years there wasn't very much deferred maintenance, but now it's about $85 million a year of what the authority has to ask for them. For the 20 of those businesses.
Maybe we ought to find who cares if it's done.
Well, I understand. Yeah, I'm more
of a thinker.
And you said the question that I'm going to ask is I find the question.
Yes.
I think you did, if you knew what the first day was, you'd help me to the
I suspected, but I was being
And I will just say that, you know, since I've been in the legislature for the last 16 years, sorry about that, my diminishing voice, gradually different districts are built, letting one more district, one more district, and one more district. And finally, I made it into two of my three. But one of them now has, it's not a perfect law because one of them doesn't need one of their buildings anymore with declining enrollment. But if they sell it as they want to and if they should, then they won't qualify for this anymore. So, it's just a really unfair law on a lot of respects.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Good luck with you, Debbie.
We've heard of this in the door before, haven't we? We'll have to guide the borders more carefully. Talking about border protection. It's different kind of pace, but. Welcome, thank you for coming here today. Thank you for all the interest in me again, Mr. Lecter.
And I'm the end of the chapter, and I'm
have a plan for how to do a community service. So we do have some special stuff. And in particular, the right now, we have about
providing the capital of the development. And with the renovations that we need to do for our building, we're hoping that as you make that possible, we can reserve fund money that we make that money available when we're doing renovations.
I do have a question. When we were listening to the presentation here from as far as the funding and the tuition resources that occur in the district, how does that compare with yours? Do you have any idea why the health and safety money can't be used for the elevator or the sprinkler system? Because somebody said it's South Delphi and that's their lot.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm not quite sure about this, but generally speaking, health and safety covers removing hazards but not replacing. So I'm not sure if it would cover the cost of removing the old cylinder. But that would leave the elevator without a way to go up and down, of course. But I think generally speaking, health and safety will cover removing the old hazards. Is that not the case?
That's not what we use for. We actually replaced the elevator in the building about 5 years ago. Because we knew the old one wasn't in good shape and the building was too low and it was far between the elevator. So our member district actually has paid for that improvement. We're going to just remove the elevator.
What is the hazard between the cylinder that is causing the cylinder to be
if I may, I may have missed something. When the presentation, talking about the tuition gap, you started your testimony about the haves and the have-nots. In what way is your school district a have-not compared to others? As far as the amount of student tuition you're getting from the school district, is there a differential there? What is the...
Well, I think the
job
not is the
customized facilities are in the district.
their only way to recapture that is to release levies. And otherwise, you know, other costs are generally more.
So you're participating as we're spending a significant amount of money spending from the other parts from other areas.
In our membership area, Mr. Chair, the 13 memberships that we have, about half of them have already tapped out their use levy capacity. So they've used all that up and are pulling money out of other pots. And as I said, we are only about halfway through our facility plan. So without additional relief or increase in those use levy amounts, they will increasingly bear that cost out of their other pots.
About half
have
reached that limit now.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, I'm Elon, I'm going to hear from Ms. Parker, but I don't want you to answer
the
question about the elevator info, the staff and where it's coming
from. All right. Would you like to... seminar?
We're on the education system, so it doesn't have the capacity for us to charge enough facilities. We actually have to address $7 million for our facility and education. So our member district is put down on the $7
million. Mr. Crow, have you two discussed this issue thoroughly enough yet? Did it make sense? Oh. Welcome. Would you introduce yourself? And our question was, yes. So where are you at in this process of the graduation? How long have you been aware of this issue? found out in August 15th. So when will we, when will this period of rule writing or interpretation commence?
Who's building code was that? And after that, federal or state, and then it's the health and safety statute, so we can just change it. And that's what we do with the note. So that's what we could do. So that could be part of this committee's recommendation.
Another area of possible action. Anything else? Let's start. Remind everyone, we're going to try to complete our work here by 3:30. Welcome to the committee, and we'll introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Greenberg with the Association of Metropolitan School District. And I actually can be quite brief because the issues that are on our platform, which is coming on right now, have already been covered, but in the previous. We look in the middle panel of the campus. If the first bullet here, we are advocating for expansion of the alternative facilities and lending program. It doesn't make sense to restrict that access based on the size of the square footage of the school district. It's much more sensitive to the age of the building. Secondly, even if we do expand access to that program, though, there will still be school districts that will not be eligible for it. Thus, it would still be important to increase the revenue available in the program. Currently, that's $50 per pupil, and our recommendation would be to increase that $100 per pupil. The next bullet is the lease levy authority, and we just had a discussion on that, so I won't rehash that. And then our final bullet, Mr. Chairman, is really addressing technology. I think that is an important topic to keep in mind, even though it's not directly a facilities issue. It's still a capital issue that we have fallen way behind in Minnesota. In fact, if you look at national rankings, they're rather poorly. I think Education Week, and we came on earlier this year, and we just gave Minnesota big G's and probably. In terms of computer access, internet access to our students. Well, I would say that that means you can be able to have this
question. Thank you very much. Is Superintendent Steele? Would it be possible for the school community? Well, we'll start with you and then. Participate in something a little more informally. Welcome to the committee, and you will introduce yourself.
Thank you, Kathy Lee. I'm the superintendent for the Denver Public School. So, thank you, Representative Benson and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk a little bit about some of our facility challenges. In the Denver Public Schools, we did a comprehensive facility study in 2004 to identify the deferred maintenance. And facilities needs that we have in our district. We're a district of 4,200 students, and we have nine sites that are part of the Roman Public School. We identified $18 million in deferred maintenance needs in order to bring bring these buildings up to the standards that are recommended for learning environments. As a part of this facility study, we began holding community forums and focus groups pertaining to some of our finance and facilities needs. Out of this, we actually had a focus group of business people who recommended that the district discontinue using three of our older buildings and put the money that would need to go into those deferred maintenance needs in those buildings into a new facility. So at that point, we convened the community stakeholders group to take a look at a proposal for a new facility. And this has now been brought forward to our Board of Education, and they're currently in the process of analyzing the recommendations of our community stakeholder group and really taking a look at all of our deferred maintenance needs as well as the possibility of a new building. So we have not yet approached the voters about a bond issue, but certainly that is on the horizon for us. One of the things that we're grappling with at this point are some of the space requirements and acreage requirements for a new building. We're looking at the possibility of a new elementary school that would serve around 750 students, and in opening such a facility, we would be able to continue using two to three of our older sites that are 60 years plus, and of course avoid that deferred maintenance cost. But one of the things that we're finding is that the spaces where some of these older schools are really very desirable for a new site. But the acreage requirements for the building type that we're looking at is in the neighborhood of 22 acres. So what's happening, and this is happening in other districts as well, when you're anticipating building a new facility, you're often encouraged or indeed required to move way beyond the center of your community, even though you might have space that would be very usable. And what happens is, as you get further away, you might find some more reasonable land prices, but the infrastructure costs are astronomical every time you bring in sanitary sewer, water, and the other elements that are necessary. In addition, we're finding that there certainly can be costs associated with having the necessary roadways available surrounding the school from a safety and security standpoint. If there would be more flexibility on the acreage requirements, we would be able to perhaps use one of our existing sites, or at least a portion of it, and then we actually would need less new land brought into the equation. Some of the land that is close to one of these facilities is, was for sale for $81,000 per acre. We were able to talk to the landowner. We have right now a proposal for $74,000 an acre, which is just a lot of money for an acre of land. And just public input at this point is not very favorable towards that kind of expenditure on top of all of the building costs. We do know that the more we can use existing properties, we can understand just what the flexibility is available in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But in greater Minnesota, this has not been something that's been afforded to districts as an option. And basically, by having a school building more in the center of a community, often there's a great deal of residential housing around that facility. Many students are able to walk to school to avoid some of the transportation costs. Another advantage that comes about is the fact that often when you're in the nucleus of a community, you have a better opportunity for other partnerships that lend themselves to being near a school. An example would be YMCA, for example. But the further we move these schools out to the outer fringes of a community, the further we do get away from the opportunity for partnerships and some of the other things that I mentioned previously. So what we would hope is that the review and comment is taking place and we're considering the age requirements, that really a great deal of attention will be given to a specific community's needs, looking at the assets that a community has, looking at the rationale that they have for where a building should be located. And if that means that we less acres that you require, so yes, it might really be an advantage to the stakeholders and the taxpayers and serve our students better as well. So that would be one of the things that we would ask you to be considering when you approach this next session. I will also say that the deferred maintenance costs are really ranging not only for the Denver Public Schools, but across the state, and obviously we've heard some of that today. And the more flexibility that we have in tapping into funds that can help us maintain our schools, of course, the better off we'll be in making sure that the learning environment is suitable for our students at all ages. So any attention that you can give to providing the necessary funding that really is required to keep our facilities up to date would be much appreciated.
Besides my responsibilities in teaching and research, I also serve as the chair of the Regional Planning Commission and have served numerous times on the Longwood Planning Facilities Committee, so the Independent School District 77. And those experiences have shaped me in my comments to the commission. Since the 20s, planners have used the concept of the neighborhood unit, in which there would be a neighborhood that consists of an area that would have at its center the schools and other civic buildings. And that's been the basic principle that we've used. Increasingly, that model is becoming less and less, it's becoming more problematic because increasingly school sites have been growing larger and larger, and the number of children per household in the residences surrounding schools have been getting fewer and fewer. And so this model is starting to break down. In the packet that I've recently already received, there's a copy of the New Urban News in 2007, which reports on a movement to, among the states to renew minimum site standards for schools. The Council of Education, the Facility Planners International, which publishes the major source of school facility guidelines, in 2004 removed the minimum site standards from its guidelines. In 2003, there were 27 states that had minimum guidelines. Now, since then, three states have removed their guidelines. So now a minority of the states, of the 50 states, 24, have minimum site guidelines. One of those states is South Carolina. The Republican governor of South Carolina, Mark Sanford, argued that the acreage requirements make the students too dependent on vehicular transportation and must have to walk to school. As a result of the large lot size that is needed, as Wilmer is experiencing. Minnesota has a requirement for elementary schools that ends up being about 10 to 15 acres for an elementary school. Among the states, among those that do have seniors, the average is about 7.9 acres. And the range is 3 acres to 14 acres. So Minnesota's 10 to 15 acres puts us at the high end of those states that even have such minimum acreage requirement. The reason for this creep in size of lots for schools comes really from the 50s, 60s, and 70s when schools would be located, but they didn't need to be enlarged. But then came the baby bust, and that need for additional space for potential future growth, portable classrooms, whether it's temporary in the form of portable classrooms or permanent in the form of positions, that pressure has eased considerably since the time that I believe the CDFPI standards were first issued in 1953. And that pressure has eased a lot since then.
Yes, certainly. Is the acreage requirement of the school based on the students that are in that facility then?
It is both. There is a minimum, in most states that have minimum requirements have a requirement of 5 acres, 10 acres, plus an acre for often for 100 students, which is why the requirement is somewhat flexible. And when I'm saying the minimum requirement is 7.9 acres, that's the base requirement. It doesn't take into account the additional acres required for each 100 students. The smart growth coordinator for the Federal Environmental Pollution Agency has been arguing, it makes the point that one of the reasons for the problem is that the funding for school construction and the funding for school transportation come from completely different pots. And so the potential savings aren't recognized by either because they can't take the money from the one pot and put it into the other. And so as a result, we have an inefficiency. We've been creating an inefficiency because the money is not fungible between the two sides. Also, an architect at the University of Michigan has made the point that there are a number of non-traditional venues, the Wellstone School in downtown St. Paul comes to mind, Wellstone Academy. There are a number of, and also the one in the Mall of America, there are a number of non-traditional venues that could very well be themselves as schools, but wouldn't meet the minimum site requirements. And in this New Urban News, there's a description of one example of a successful smaller site school in Texas that gives me an example of how that goes. What's happening in the planning profession is in the last 10 years, we've been talking increasingly about concepts like urban villages, or it has lots of names, new urbanism, sustainable design. And the principles that are embodied in that, the first principle is walkability, and I noticed in your notes that that heading is missing on the top of page 2. It was there in my text on the computer, but it didn't get printed. So that it should be it should say walkability, but one of the first principles of new urbanism is to get people to design places so people can walk or bike to where they're going to go. Second is density. In order to achieve walkability, you need higher densities than the suburban densities that we've gotten used to. Third principle is mixed use, which would incorporate among planners. We would like to see schools incorporated in mixed uses and incorporated into the commercial areas and more closely tied to the surrounding residential areas. And then the third issue of open space, and schools can provide some of the open space that the neighborhood community uses. Most of us probably remember our childhoods playing in the school grounds after this, or when the school was closed. Also, in thinking about this, cities and suburbs have different issues. The principles are the same, but the issues are different. A city block, to give you some reference, a city block is about 3 to 5 acres. In size. So a 10-acre requirement is about 3 city blocks. On a 3-acre city block, if you're using 7,000 square feet block, which is a standard city size block, you can get 9 houses along the street block, or 18 houses on the block, 18 houses. And so when you're talking about a school of 10 acres, you're talking about 60 households that aren't there. In the middle of the space. So the additional acreage means less residential land available, fewer households, rights for schools. In older urban areas, the issue is land is scarce. And so what developers in those areas are trying to use as small a space as possible and as high a density as possible. And so their pressures are always, how can we use less? In suburban areas, their tendency is to large lots. Half acre is not uncommon in 22,000 square feet, sometimes an acre. And their issue is how can we use more space? And in suburban areas, with cul-de-sacs, designs that are not particularly walkable are considered desirable. And so planners have different issues in suburbs than they have in urban areas. And so you'll hear people coming at the same problem from different directions, and that might help you understand what is happening.
If I could interrupt. Yes. Because, so one of our problems, maybe historically, particularly through Henry Ford and his Model T business, as far as the suburban urban issues here.
Henry Ford, you also could attribute it to the death of the streetcar. And that was General Motors. But,
yeah. Although that's supposedly an urban
map. Yes, right.
But if I can just piggyback on it, I'm also serving on the subcommittee on redesign of high schools. And all the testimony we're getting, or very large scientific testimony we're getting, has to do with the issue of larger schools being amalgamating large numbers of children into a building, whereas the native learning environments seem to be enhanced if the school is a smaller size. So when you had mentioned, for example, 700 children, was that an elementary school?
Yeah, and the plan that we're looking at is shared common space and then actually two schools attached to it. And yes, elementary. But we would get some economy by having shared gym space, cafeteria space, and then the learning wings, if you will, would be almost separate entities because it would be very family friendly, and children would go K through 4 in that environment, and that families should become very familiar with
it. All the good things about it. I was glad to hear that because it seems that this differentiation is really psychologically important to also for children. But, almost like the college campus sense in a way, when you have a very strong how you want to configure your learning. We do have other things like so maybe in a couple minutes.
I'll just give you a few examples from each school. The Titan Fencing is 77. We have one school, I think the School District 77, elementary education is based on neighborhood amount. And as much as possible, we try to keep the kids in their own neighborhood with the grown ups. And so one of our schools, Dorfeld School, was built in 1927. It's has 150 students in it. It sits on 3 acres. When site planning committees that have been on, when we raised the issue of what are we going to do with this building, how much money should we bring into it, one of the issues that keeps coming back on us is, well, it's below standard. And so even though on everything else it actually rates very well, on the scoring system, the school district uses when it comes to the site for those that come in. And yet, when we talk to the community about closing the school and building a new one, the community gets up in arms because it would mean that the nearest location is a mile and a half away outside the city limits, where you can get enough and we can find 10 to 15 acres, and actually, I'll say in a minute, are 50 to 20 acres of land for locating it in the community and saying, no, wait a minute, then all of our kids are going to have to shift, and no one's going to be able to walk there. We have another building, which is actually a high school, Lincoln Community Center, also on 3 acres, built in 1921. And that one is not being used as a high school, and it's being used as the ultimate high school and community education and those kinds of things, because it sits on 3 acres and can't do the changes that it needs to do. From our long-range planning facilities, what we've concluded is that it costs about the same to renovate these old buildings as it would cost to build new. But when we go to the community, their response is renovate. We want to keep our communities intact. We take them out of our neighborhood, we will destroy the neighborhood character. Therefore, it costs about the same renovation as further. We are looking at two new sites. The city is growing, and so there are areas that aren't served. And there we're having to look at 20 acres. And that limits where we can put it and put it out in their ag land, being able to infrastructure across the city.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just was going to say, it looks like when Representative Dunphy comes forward with his bill, he's got a witness to a fight.
I think, thank you very much, Ben.
Could you look up the department comment a little about the process we use in Minnesota? And I think it's important for the committee to understand what the rule versus what the commissioner's decision on the committee's conference.
What we find, and we find this question, is that the idea of neighborhood schools that are here, and we are certainly those neighborhood schools that are frequently the shortest men of the land, at times when we do have a district of the economy, that we need to know that what's happening. What we find frequently on the small community is that, for example, a cell phone bill is being used. That for building time in a school, we're not using the building to be able to school buildings far more for recreation, community use, parking, high school, school parking. So that the site size. I expected to be able to get a copy of the recreation space, et cetera. We give a lot of the guidelines because, fortunately, in some of the recreation kind of covers, something like that, so that there's a good space that we can compare to the city kind of covers and our primary concern in looking at those site sizes, and I think we have to be a little bit more careful on their size. And then compare like the elementary and local time times everything large and healthy. And then we consider changes outside that should have adequate space for those kids to help and get reason during those times to be difficult for people to use. So we're looking at adequate space for regulations. Space, bus, and bus pickup drop off, and stress pickup and drop off. Separated so that you don't have kids running around the car or running around the bus when you need to start on the car. So the other things that we always do is that they're often not stories. That we have to send people to the center of the car. But I think that's a good thing.
Thank you. Now, if I just may make a few comments, Chair Riley, Chair Faust. I want everyone here to know that I'm one of the naive freshman legislators who spent his career in the classroom responding to directives from someone else. And I have to tell you, I have a tendency to show extreme naive, you know, that I'm very naive about all this, but I really don't understand why local districts are not allowed to make these decisions on their own, with the help and suggestions from the State Board of Education or the State Department of Education. Why would a State Department of Education, is it based on statute that you can direct local school districts on these issues rather than allowing the local districts to make these decisions, for good or ill? I mean, in one of my districts, for example, there are athletic facilities off campus, a little farther away, where they were able to acquire land at a reasonable cost. And at the same time, they were able to renovate and maintain their local school. This is something the parents wanted. This is something the local school board wanted and chose. Why is there statutory language that does not allow local school districts to make this decision? I just, you know, I want to turn it over to you. And I was hearing you discuss, I know, the school, for example, was built in 1922 in Mankato. They want to do renovation, and they want to replace it and build it on the same location. At least I know that, you know, my hackles go up when I hear someone who does not live in the community telling the community that they can't do that. So, you know, that's where I'm coming from. I don't know. Maybe.
I think that this is very important. What we are looking for is that we access both the resources, but that it is safe for us, that it is adequate for the education.
I understand all that. My point is, I don't think someone, frankly, in St. Paul, in an agency, a better understanding of the needs of the local district than people like that. That's just a philosophical position I have. Anyway,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just say, when I was in the first term in the legislature, I cut my teeth on chairing a subcommittee on administrative rules, and we learned there that a guideline is a rule if it's enforced. And so it really should have gone through rulemaking. And this one clearly is enforced because the review and comments, you know, dictates the passage rate and so forth of a bond issue in the community. So, you know, I think it's a very, I'm glad you're bringing, you know, we wanted to have this topic concluded because Dr. Filipovich talked to his wife actually about that, who's a state legislator, Representative Briner, and she asked that, you know, we might think this was a great issue to look at during the interim. So I'm so glad that this committee is looking at it. And then just serendipitously, we have an actual bill from Representative Junty for Superintendent Leeson and Wilmer. So we will be discussing this and the appropriateness of should it be the legislature or should it be some agency folks up in St. Paul deciding for the community. So I guess I'd like to ask maybe Dr. Filipovich, I think we know what the department is doing, and we've heard your rationale, and then I'd like to ask you too after hearing from him, but you said over half the states have had the, or never had them, or did and got rid of them due to changing circumstances. Do you think with the research that you've done on this that there should be even any minimum acreage for the department to have in their guidelines or to have in statute, or should it just be up to the school board, should the legislature make laws on it, or should we just get out of the way?
What I see is that the guideline is used to fill the discussion of a lower space alternative or the discussion on the grounds of not reconsidering something with the guidelines, let's move on without the issue. Mm-hmm. Usually, time is already short. So let's move on to that practice. Mm-hmm. I think in practice, most schools, most districts will still be looking at those kinds of guidelines. We'll still be looking at those kinds of spaces. And suspicion is that they're going to strike the border as one or close to it.
730 kids are going to get that.
So the 3 acres, the neighborhood school in Montevideo is an unusual circumstance. But in those cases where the community wants it, they shouldn't be, should be able to. The minimums, a specified minimum is to, it has the effect of limiting creativity. It also has the effect of making it very difficult for the other stakeholders in this, the city and the resident community, to try to bring forward innovative ideas on to how things could be done. For example, recreational space, if there's a YMCA, our little 3 acre school is half a block away from the YMCA. Would it be possible to interchange students within that case? Very well could be. And you know, so both, you know, facts and circumstances can start. So I would argue that the minimums are used to limit the discussion. They have the effect of killing the discussion.
Any other questions?
Would you like to follow up on the discussion?
Okay, should I ask you?
Sure.
You weren't giving us what is, and that's, you know, obviously what you have to implement. But I'm asking, given over time, you know, the changing situations and the fact that we don't have the increasing numbers of students in those districts anymore, and more communities are urbanized than just Minneapolis and St. Paul, which do have, don't have to follow these guidelines. I'm just wondering what your opinion of that is on the same question. Should the legislature supersede the guidelines and just have it be a local decision, and if you did that, should there be a minimum acreage at least?
Thank you.
Any other closing comments?
Thank you for
thank you. We have others here. Gentlemen, some of you would like to make some comments in this regard? Yes, would you introduce yourself?
I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Educational Institutions, the checklist, so they'll go through and say, okay, are you considering these items? contribute to the learning environment and also to sustainability. I've got some handouts here that I will leave with you that are just informational. I think we're going to be the end of it. But they're basically tell them about the success and the process that they've gone through, which I think is very valuable for both students and administrators. So, energy is on everybody's minds now. Energy costs are one of the top five budget figures in the school district. And I think that it's really important for us to consider when we look at new buildings or renovations, to consider the technologies and the materials out there that contribute to a better building. I think it's our responsibility, our mission, our responsibility to the taxpayer that they get what they deserve. That's part of the school's issue, tax money passed, and the system passed, I think we'll continue to look for it. And building that kind of spend for money. And I would even go out on the amendment and say that I would, and I suggested for several years ago, ignoring the school's tax, and I understand why. But I think it's important that maybe we have a town space like a middle tech, like elementary, like middle school, or high school, that has this new canopy, and we size it a little bit, so we have a trip and see what it's about. Thank you for your time, and I will be Mr. Powell.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? We are running a little long. Mr. Moore? Mr. Carlson? Is it? Mr. Frederickson.
Thank you, Chairman Benson. I'm John Frederickson, Assistant Superintendent for the Administration for the Oscar School, which takes up quite a few times. I want to say thank you for the developments of the deferred maintenance program and the funding for health and safety. We have about 3.7 million square feet under roof and have had some really good success with that. It is a little bit of a load on our taxpayers. We'd like to present to you sometime in the near future some legislation that might help create some flexibilities and some efficiencies in the health and safety deferred maintenance processes that might address some of the issues we had earlier in regards to the elevator group. We think that there are some opportunities there that can be to make it a little easier administratively and especially just from the cost of the taxpayer. And thanks for the opportunity to have Karen out here and save us some money.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here today who would like to make comments or about? Thank you all for coming, for your testimony. It was very useful to me. I think members of the committee and I will take it seriously. Thank you very much. Thank you.